This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to the April 19th, 2021 For Your Benefit radio show. And this is also Financial Literacy Month. And who better than to lead us in a discussion of financial planning would be Joel Kundick. Joel is a certified financial planner, fellow seminar presenter, and counselor to anyone that wants to hear good counseling information. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning, Bob. Good to be with you this morning.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to taking notes and maybe even ask a question as we go through. So we're talking today about goal setting and the importance of time horizons. All righty, what goal do I need to set and what's my time horizon?
Well, it's funny when I kick off most seminars with a discussion about goals and I get some head scratches, kind of and quizzical looks like, why are we starting here? There's so much more I want to talk about. And I find goal planning is actually the basis of all good financial planning. One of my favorite bloggers out there is Carl Richards. He talks about a good financial advisor does three things, and two of them have to do with goals. One is helping you articulate your goals. Two is helping you stay towards your goals, right? Three is just handling everything else, right? The things that come up, but two have to do with goals. And so I think that goal planning is really the basis of good financial planning.
Okay. Now, when you talk about goal planning, one size does not fit all, I would imagine.
No, it doesn't. And I think there's a lot of disservice that's done to individuals and families as they're trying to get their heads around what should I do financially. There's a lot of rules of thumb out there that they'll try and kind of convince you, oh, you need 10 times your income in life insurance, or, oh, you need X times your income saved by the time you're age 40 or age 50. And I just find that a lot more of good financial planning, goal planning is personal than financial planning. It has to, this is another thing Carl Richards says, actually, personal financial planning is much more personal than financial, right? And so I know it's difficult to do on a radio program like this, but my goal today in talking about this subject is to have each of the listeners hear a little bit about where they're at in life and how to customize this to them.
So if I had not heard you before and I had sat in on a class, I'm not so sure I would know what to ask you. I think I understand a little bit, I should probably put more money into the thrift or I need to watch it more closely, but I'm just somewhat uncomfortable with it. I understand what I do for my job. I understand what I do for my family and friends. But this is, this was always something maybe parents didn't talk about in front of their kids. And maybe it was something that I didn't pay much attention to in college because I was more interested in becoming a graduate with a degree in X, but not finance. So how do you talk to somebody like me?
Sure. Well, I think the starting place is getting rid of the guilt that comes with finances. People stay away from this topic because it makes them feel bad. It makes them feel like I haven't done enough, or I don't know enough, or I haven't read the Wall Street Journal enough. I would be so much better off with my money if I just paid attention to these things. I find that some of the best financial planning topics are short-term boring, long-term exciting. Way to pitch my segment here with you this morning.
I like that.
Boring, but it gets to long-term. None of the short-term stuff you do in financial planning that really helps you a lot is all that exotic and exciting. And it means that we have a whole industry cropped up of financial media that is focusing on the wrong stuff because they want to talk about the flashy and the exciting and the, hey, which stock to buy today or where did markets go today? So much of that is irrelevant to people who are really trying to get to a successful retirement.
All right. So in dealing with them, I'd imagine they come in more than one flavor. But the flavor, I mean, one that heard you and say, I need to understand this better, but I it doesn't turn me on. Or, you know, I understand some of this, but I need to understand more. And then you probably some of the other ones. I need to set a goal, but I only have 5 years left on my work career. So
right.
How do you talk to one of my personalities?
Right. The best time to save more was 20 years ago, but the next best time is today. Right. So I get, let's take things where we're at right now. And let's start with, all right, how do I articulate where I'm headed? There was a real great ad campaign a number of years ago that I don't like a lot of the ad campaigns. This one was good, though. I think it was Fidelity that had people walking around with a number over them, right? And the people who had done the work knew what their number was. And the people who didn't know that have the work done said something like bajillion dollars over their head, right? If you don't have a sense of where you're headed for, it's very difficult to get there. That's where we're starting with goals. We're saying, hey, I need to know in order to map. So many people want to start out with, well, tell me what we're going to do on this road. Well, I need to know first where we're at, and then I need to know where we're going. And then I'm going to tell you which road we're on and how we get there. So the way that we evaluate where we're at right now is by building a good cash flow statement. All right. Cash flow statement means pulling up my bank account statements and my credit card statements from the last 3 to 6 months and saying, where has the money gone? Right. And it's not generally the income. The income is easy. People can tell me to the penny what they've got earned on income. But on expenses, people have a lot of thought, oh, I just don't know where my money is going. I don't have a sense of that. Well, it's not all that difficult. It just takes a little time. Print up your bank account statements and your credit card statements and make categories for yourself. Where did my money go? Once you have a sense of that, the next thing we're going to try and figure out is, all right, where am I trying to get to? And with a goal, what I'm trying to get to is I need to know the dollar amount of the goal, and I need to know the time horizon of the goal. I need to know how many years is it going to be until I need the money for that goal. That's where we're starting.
All right. Could I walk you through mentally my first stage? Let's say I'm young, middle 20s, somewhere in there, but not yet 30. And I know I have to do something, but I enjoy the money that I now have that I didn't have when I was in school. How do I take my first step?
Sure. The important thing, where I know we're talking to a federal audience here, the first thing before anything else is put 5% in the TSP. I don't even need to look at your statement to tell you that. And I'll tell you why I know that. The reason I know that is because when I put 5% into the TSP, the government puts in another 5%. That is called 100% return on money. And I, as a financial advisor, can't find any investment that is going to do that for you. That is free money, right? There's a 1% automatically that they put in, whether I put in a dollar or not. Then they match dollar for dollar on my first 3% of contributions. And then they match 50% per dollar on the next 2%. So if I put in 5, the government puts in 5. That is very powerful. Now, let's say somebody feels like they can't get there right now. They're in their mid-20s. They're like, I don't think I could even come close to doing that. Then put in 1. Put in 1 this year. Put in 2 next year. 3 the year after that. We'll get to 5 over time. I care much more, if you're in your early 20s, about the destination you're getting to than the speed at which you get to it, right? If I get myself over the next 3 or 4 years to 5%, and it's not going to be that painful each time because it's just 1%, and hopefully we've got some cost of living adjustments coming in there too. That's the place to start. Now, the next thing, if you're in your 20s, is generally you've got debt, right? You've got debt that you've accumulated over your college years. Hopefully you don't have too much credit card debt, but we've got to get out of debt. And getting out of debt, there's no mystery to it. It's just figuring out a set amount of money each month that I can put toward something. It's carving it out from things that you're doing that you don't think really are adding up. Like, you know, David Bach is a great retirement personality. He talks about the latte factor. People are putting things like $5 a day to coffee, right? And then that adds up to $25 a week, which is $100 a month, which is $1,200 a year. And all of a sudden I've got an amount that if I were to get a little bit more discipline, not much, just a little, I can start putting real money towards paying down that debt. I think if you're in your 20s and getting started, Matt, get the 5% of the TSP and then getting a handle on how I'm going to get out of debt, the best place to start.
And how hard, I mean, you've got different people that come in and they think differently, or they come in with debt, or they're just out of school, maybe 2 or 3 years, but they don't feel comfortable that they're building their financial fortress. But they're spenders. How do you slow down a spender?
Well, one of the ways is to get them thinking about their future self. And some of the best research out there has said, actually, there was an app a little while ago that would, if you uploaded a picture of yourself, the app would age the picture and have you look the way you'd look at 65, 70, 80. The research says that if people will look at that picture of themselves aged, they will start making better decisions on behalf of that future self, because it has more concreteness around it, right? And I don't need to get that granular with somebody in their 20s. What I really need them to do is be disciplined about the big two. The big two are car and housing, all right? Because we can spend a whole lot of time talking about the ways to save on a coffee a day or to buy, you know, the more simple groceries or not eat out as much. None of those things are going to save them as much as, but being disciplined on their car purchase and being disciplined on the kind of housing that they get for themselves. And the housing decision is just so interesting. All of the tentacles that blow out from that. The place that I live is not just what my spend on rent or mortgage. It's where I decide to vacation. It's where I decide to eat out with friends. It's how much car I think I should have because of the cars the people around me are driving. If it's a house, it's how much should I spend on landscaping by how much all the neighbors are spending, right? We're very relativistic beings. So if we can get those big two down, we're going to get a much better handle on being disciplined on expenses.
So when people come in, let's talk about the younger ones that come in. Do they have a realistic idea that they don't need to buy the house of their dreams for the first or second house? That, you know, the first house is a place that you might be for 2 to 5 years. And yeah. then as their income grows, maybe they make it shorter than that.
I think the ones who do this right are the ones who separate housing from status. And this is a tricky thing with money. Money, there's so many lessons we learned about money growing up that weren't necessarily stated out loud. But we got an idea of like money is status, or housing is status, or position is status. Money can mean value, can mean that I am enough if I have money. And we're getting into the soft side of financial planning. It's an important place to go. I think that the biggest mistake I see somebody in their early 20s making is saying, I'll get to it someday. It's the old grasshopper and the ants parable, right? If we've seen that cartoon, the grasshopper kind of plays all summer, the ants who kind of do some work all day through the summer, and then we get to the winter, the grasshopper's freezing, the ants are fine, right? This is a good financial planning parable, okay? And I just find if people do a little bit per year, they can actually check off that box. If I get to 5% saved in my 20s and the federal government's doing 5% too, and I get to 10, that's gonna put me a lot farther on the path. Now, do I wanna see people get to 15? It depends, and that's where we're getting into some of the unique aspects of financial planning for federal employees in general, but also for each individual family.
Very good. Andrew says it's time to take a break, and we can look at that after we hear some sound advice from an outfit called WEPA, who sponsors our show.
Over 46,000 feds choose WEPA to be there for their life's biggest moments. Group term life insurance is a smart option if you're looking for coverage that'll help meet your changing needs. At WEPA, eligible employees can apply for up to $1.5 million in life insurance regardless of salary. We also offer other coverage options such as group short-term disability insurance or a chronic illness rider. WEPA has been serving civilian federal employees for over 75 years. Get life insurance on your terms. Visit WAEPA.org for more information.
WEPA helps provide coverage today that will protect your tomorrow. Group term life insurance coverage is important to have while building your future. Whether you're saving to buy your first home, starting your first federal job, or beginning a family, establish your WEPA policy now, and you can carry it with you into retirement. WEPA has been insuring the future of civilian federal employees for more than 75 years. Find coverage that fits your future by visiting WAEPA.org today.
All righty. Back with Joel Kundick, and we're talking financial planning. And from the grassroots on up to wherever we're going to be in the next 30-some minutes, right, Andrew? And we're talking about goal setting and the importance of time horizons. And you laid, you know, time horizons out very nicely. It's Financial Literacy Month. So I think we're all pointed in the right direction. So let's pick up right before the spot came on.
Yeah, we were talking about how we get a little bit more customized to federal employees when, in our goal planning. I said, you know, I'd love to see people at 5% plus they're deferring for retirement plus the federal match of 5%. We have to be mindful if we're going to have a good federal career, then there is going to be a pension to us at the end of our career called the federal annuity, right? So that means that all of the rules of thumb you're hearing about on TV or in the radio or in the news media, they're not necessarily applicable to you. If I can get to a 5%, and this is, I know this is kind of revolutionary. If I can get to 5% deferred for retirement in my early 20s and a match of 5%, I may be on a path to have enough for retirement with only 10% per year saved. The best personalities out there are all saying you need to save 15% a year. Now, let's say I'm starting in my 30s or my early 40s. People are saying you should save 20% a year. Well, that rule of thumb doesn't necessarily apply to you if you're a federal employee because you're going to get the annuity. So it does get a little bit more customized. I want to start figuring out where are you trying to get to? All right, let's talk a little bit about that articulated goal. Once I said at the beginning, I need to know where I'm at right now, which means that I need to map out how much am I spending per month. That knowledge of how much I am spending per month is very powerful in starting to project towards goals. If I know that I'm spending $6,000 a month right now, and I fast forward that, I think it's going to be pretty similar at my retirement age, how much I'm going to be spending. Now I know I need $6,000 per month. Well, the next thing I need to know is, all right, when do I want retirement to start? Do I want to start at 62, 65, 70? I mean, and that, again, I have all kinds of different situations I come across when I'm talking with clients. Some say to me, I never want to stop working. That's okay. If you love what you do, you're having a lot of fun and you're not really into golf, and you know that you'd just like to continue doing this, well, we should know that. And we should plan out our goals accordingly. Now, I don't really want to start retirement later than 70, just for purposes of planning, because so many things can go wrong. But I do want to be mindful of that and not put on someone on the same goal path as someone who's saving for retirement at 62, right? So I want to know how many dollars per month are you looking to spend, and when are you looking for the goal to start? And then the other thing I need to know is how long is the goal going to last? And now we get into a little bit of family history and into the matter, right? I mean, do we have a history of long life? Do we have a history of heart attacks? Do we have a history of cancer? I just want to be kind of mindful of that and build goals mindful for that. But retirement as the one goal that unifies us all, right? All of us have a retirement goal at some point. It's different for everyone. I want to know, when is it going to start? When do you want to plan for it to be able to last to? And how much money do you want to be able to spend per month? Once you have given me all of that, now I can do the kind of the back of the napkin calculations, you know, through my system as an advisor to say, all right, 6,000 per month, starting at 65, ending at 95, that's a 30-year retirement. That's actually not one goal. It's a series of 30 goals, right? If you will, right? We've got a retirement spend at 65, retirement spend at 66, retirement spend at 67, but I know my time horizon, and that gives me a lot more power. Now, let's say that I'm age 40 right now, and my goal is 25 years away. That is my time horizon for my goal. I don't need that money until then. And as a result, that is going to back us into what kind of investment strategy we should use with that kind of time horizon. Very different from somebody who's coming across the table from me and saying, my kids are going to college in 5 years. How should I invest that? We get very different investment paths depending on time horizon.
I like what you just said, but what you just said, I would imagine, is more often the case than not. Somebody says, I want to do this. And you'd say, okay, generally speaking, this is what it's going to cost to get you to your goal. And then they go, uh-oh, that means, like you say, the car. I want a car now every 3 or 4 years. And you tell them, nah, you drive it to the tires fall off. Not really. But so what they hear is psychological, I think, was I can't do that. I can't part with the money. So how do you ease that person into the fast lane? They got to come off the ramp and get across and get in the fast lane.
Good question. Well, I think the first thing I do is just understand all of the everything else under the surface, right? What you've just said to me is kind of the tip of the iceberg. There's a number of other things going on the surface. That could mean that they're unhappy with their job right now. They just want to stop because it's exhausting them. It could mean that, you know, they have they've just had grandchildren, and so they want to be spending time with them. There's other things that they want to be doing. One of the things we can do with people who aren't going to quite make it on what they've told me their goals are is build a bit of a transition in, right? Where we're spending less time at work, but not stopping work altogether. And I have a colleague who calls that a victory lap retirement. I really like that concept. And we're saying, all right, we can't maybe stop full stop right now, right? Where you're feeling like you've got to make the change. Although I'm very reluctant to put in my values into, you know, it's not me. It's not about me when I'm sitting across the table from someone. It's about them. So sometimes people say, well, can I retire now? And I say, well, here's what the numbers say. Here's how much you can spend if you retire now. If you retired 3 years from now, here's what the numbers say you'll be able to spend then. And I let the numbers do the talking, right? It's not, I'm not, there's no rocket science behind this. There's good, solid Nobel Prize winning research, absolutely, into evidence-based investing and staying strategic, right? Nothing about what, there's no secret formula. This is important probably for our listeners to hear. There's no secret formula for good investing. The number one determinant of a successful goal attainment is going to be how much someone saves for it, not what kind of investments they use to get there. And a lot of times I sit down with people who are federal employees who, you know, every 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, they're pulling out their TSP statements and they're staring at it. And they're staring at the last 1 year return and 3 year return and 5 year return of all the different funds they're seeing in there. And they're feeling like, this is Greek to me, but I feel like I should be able to interpret this. If I were just watching things more closely, I would be able to interpret all this. And so then they kind of look at, well, the last 5 years of the C fund looks, wow, that's pretty amazing. I guess I should put more money in the C fund. Even though the caveat behind every seminar on investment says past performance is not indicative of future results. What's the thing we're using? Past performance to drive, you know, future investment decisions. And we shouldn't. What should drive our investment decisions is time horizon. We back into how many years is it until I need the money? So I had last year was a kind of an anomaly year. I had a client call me up in April. We knew that taxes weren't due until July. And he said, hey, I'm going to owe $10,000. He had sold a house the previous year or something. So I'm going to owe $10,000 in taxes, but it's April and I don't need to spend the money until July. How should I invest this? Well, I'm a time horizon guy, and I'm very disciplined about it. I said, look, you need that money in 3 months. The number one goal is to make sure that you don't have less than what you have right now. And so on that kind of time horizon, find a 3-month CD. And he said, oh, that's kind of boring. I said, well, there you go. Good financial planning is short-term boring, long-term exciting. If I have 3 years until I need the money, now I can put some bonds in there, right? If I don't need the money for 3 years, let's put in some bonds, maybe a hair of stock, but I'm not talking more than 10 or 20%. Now goals get to be more like 5+ years away. Well, here's some magic. If there's one piece of data that people can take away from the program this morning, I think this would be it. A 5-year time horizon There is no scenario in the last 90 years in which a 50% bond, 50% stock portfolio has delivered negative return over 5 years. And that can take maybe a lot of the angst and anxiety out of investment strategy to people. Because this is one of those things that, look, I'm telling you, put it under a rock, put it 50-50, stocks and bonds, put it under a rock for 5 years. You're not going to be down, at least judging by history, right? And look, we can never say that future is exactly like the past, but there's some pretty scary stuff we've gone through in history. There was a whole market collapse, you know, in 2008 that we're including in there. There's the terrorist events of 2001 and the tech bubble before that in 2000 that we're including in that. There's World War II that we're building into that. There's the Great Depression that we're building into that. Still, there's not a time period where if I put my money 50% in bonds, 50% in stocks, that I get to a five-year time period that I'm down. That's pretty powerful.
So at the end of the fifth year, these folks are more literate than what they were 5 years earlier and probably come to you with different questions. Boy, we did exactly like you said. It's good. Should we put more money in riskier investments? Maybe I want to pull some more money out of the G fund and put it in one of the other funds. Do you ease them in the water?
Well, the first thing I do, this is a great time to be talking about this, Bob, because we're 1 year past a complete market meltdown, right? And I do these seminars. I'm talking about the same topics every time. In fact, I remember I had people who had attended some seminars of mine in January of 2020 reach out to me in March of 2020 and basically say, are you sure? Because I restructured this according to what you said, and now it's pretty far down. Now, I said at that time, actually wrote a blog post about it. 3 days before the market drop, I wrote a blog post about the case for strategic allocation. And I didn't know we were 3 days from the bottom. And I didn't know we were going to be up, 50% from the numbers we were seeing then. What I know is the value is in being patient. It's not in second guessing ourselves over and over and over. So I would not have told somebody in March of 2020 to get more conservative. That's the worst thing you can do when markets are at lows, is to pull money out of stocks. Stocks are on sale right now. Leave the money in stocks. If you want to put a little bit more into stocks because you've got that kind of, you know, stomach of steel, fine, go ahead and do that. But don't go more conservative then. Now people are coming to me a year later and saying, hey, should we put some more money to stocks? And I'm the opposite side of things now. I'm kind of holding people back saying, hey, remember, we're strategic investors. We're going for the long term. Actually, what I'm doing with my clients is I'm trimming their stock allocation by a bit right now, because stock allocation could be maybe about 5% over my target long-term allocation because of just how much stocks have grown. We're dialing back a bit. And that's the way you become a successful investor over time, is you buy when others are selling and you sell when others are buying. And over time, that steadies things out. So I would not tell somebody who's sitting with me today after 5 years to be going more into stocks right now. I'd be saying, let's look at the goals. What is the goal of the retirement that you're saving toward? Or what is the house that you're saving for? Or what is the second home that you'd like to buy someday at the beach? What are you saving for? How long is it till we need that money? And let's design the investment allocation accordingly. And then as we get closer and closer to the goal, that's when we're going to drop the stock allocation, not because markets are doing anything different, but because my time horizon until I need the money has changed.
I like what you just said. If it declines a bit, we're not talking catastrophic drops or vertical drops, a bit, but I would imagine your clients in general, would look at the market. They, you know, when it goes up, well, that's great. That's exactly what we planned. But then there might be this lull, or it might be a little bit of a back off. And they probably call up and say, is it time now to pull back out? And then we'll get back in when it starts to go up.
Yeah. Good investing is a hurry up and wait, right? Don't just do something, stand there approach, right? And if this is a matter of training us to act differently than in our minds we think we need to act. We see a headline, and look, the media is really good at making that headline, right? It's designed for us to click on it. Here's what investors should do today, or markets are collapsing because they're off 2%, or markets are, you know, are wildly positive because they're up 3%. I got to back everybody away from that and remind them about their time horizon, remind them about their long-term goals. We don't act based on every headline that we're seeing. In fact, if we act on those headlines, we're more likely to damage ourselves than help.
All righty. Then there's, with all your good tutelage, do you find sometimes that the folks that you gave them the path, they went down the path, everything was fine, do they want to pull back and do some of the things that they didn't get to do earlier, cars, vacations? Is there a percentage of the group that says, yeah, I want to make up for lost time because now I've built my fortress?
You know, it's interesting you ask that, Bob. I think that's much more consistent, and I see this a lot from federal employees, is there, I call them highly successful savers, right? There are lots of TSP millionaires out there. They didn't do anything but put money aside, go show up to work every day and just leave it and let it be. And then they get towards retirement. And what I'm having to do is tell them, you know, it's okay to spend some more. Now I get both sides, there's no question. And there, this delayed gratification thing is something we watch for. But I talk a lot about, let's make sure that we're not doing that as much as possible. I don't want to see delayed gratification. I want to see us living the life that we want to live now as we can. What would an ideal day look like for me? And what could I build into my life right now that would put me toward that ideal day? So I take control of this and not, you know, this another place the media tries to really feed us a line, right? Where retirement ads are all full of couples walking hand in hand with the dog running in front of them on the beach with a smile and nice tan skin. And, you know, we live this. No, look, retirement is going to be life. It's still going to be life. We're still going to be the same person waking up out of the bed every day that we were before. And so we want to have those healthy patterns in our lives now that we're not setting aside and just kind of saying, I'll only do that then. I'd much rather see that. But I do see very, very commonly with a federal retiree where they've actually been very disciplined savers over the course of their lives and actually getting them to come to the grips with the idea that we got to start taking some of this out is where we're going.
So I understand that. But on the other side, I like this term delayed gratification. Are there clients that are counting down the days so that they can go out and do the things that they haven't done in order to get there? And sometimes the withdrawal or the cashing in to do this isn't such a great idea.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what I tell my clients is I want to see mistakes made on paper before they're made in real life. And this is why it's so critical to have the goals written down, okay? And we know where we're trying to get to, because then the goal is the one doing the driver, not me, not them, the goal. So if somebody says to me, hey, when I retire, I want to spend X on travel per year, and I want to spend Y on grandkids per year, and I want to spend Z on a nice car that I've never had before, I'm okay with it. We just got to figure out all those dollar amounts, and we got to figure out what the resources we have right now are going to get us to do. I'll tell you an example of a good friend that I worked with a number of years ago, federal employee, age 60, said, I am sick of working. I just want to stop. I want to be done. I'm tired. They had 30 years with the federal government. And I knew as working with federal clients that, hey, there's a really nice bump at age 62, right? If you go past age 62 with 20 more years of service, you get 10% extra in your annuity. So I just made those as the two arbitrary times. I said, look, Here's what the numbers say at age 60, and here's what the numbers say at age 62. And leave it up to them to make the decision. Anybody can retire at any point if they can build a life for themselves off of the amount of income their savings have been able to generate. That's the problem. The problem is that we can't, you know, we have to save more because we haven't yet got to that number. So one of the things I've noticed that is a very strong hallmark of successful retirements is getting disciplined on spend and save. People think that it's the investment portfolio that's going to do all the work. It's actually the amount that you save for retirement that is going to drive that success. If you save more, it helps in two ways. Number one, it means that you have put more aside for retirement, so there's going to be more there for you. But number two, you've gotten used to living on less. And that means that it's going to accelerate when you're able to retire.
All right. Now, Andrew says you guys are going to be retired by the time you take a break. So Andrew would like us to take a break now and let folks know about NITP.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to the final leg of the April 19th, 2021 for your Benefit Radio Show, Financial Literacy Month. And we have Joel Kunduk, certified financial planner, knows the Feds backwards and forwards, fellow seminar presenter, and we're heading down to the final lap of the race, and we're going to win the race.
That's right. You know, I'd like to go a little bit more into talking about the TSP, because I think it's so useful for our federal listeners. As we've been talking about financial literacy, I want to give a little bit of background to where TSP's been in the past, where it is right now, and what kind of tweaks you might consider changing to it. The default option inside the TSP many years ago was the G fund. So I still meet with a lot of people who have a lot of G fund in their retirement accounts because that was what the default was. If they didn't choose something, their money went into the G fund. The G fund, great investment. I kind of call it cash plus. It can't go down in value. It's invested in U.S. short-term U.S. treasuries, and so it goes up a little bit. And I think the thinking at the time, which was very common, actually, in a lot of 401k plans around the country, was if nobody's going to choose, then we're going to put it in something that's not going to lose, right? We don't want to choose something for them that is going to lose money. And the thinking evolved over time to realizing that, wait, people don't like making decisions. So we've got to make that default something that is a little bit more powerful. And so now the default inside the TSP is the L fund or life cycle fund that is closest to what they estimate your retirement date might be. So if I start with the federal government at age 45 this year, and that means retirement, they're going to say is around 65, 20 years off from now, they will put me in the L 2040 if I don't make a decision of what I should do. And this is a place that people can take a little bit of control over their planning and look under the hood. I'm not saying it's the right answer, the wrong answer. I'm just saying lift the hood, look under it and see what is that L fund invested in. A lot of people think that L funds are unique investments inside the TSP. What L funds really are is an automatic allocation across the five funds that are in TSP, G, F, C, S, and I. Those five funds are all that's in the L's, a mixture of those five funds.
So the mixture, though, does it have an extra weight, one versus another one?
Yeah, and there's been some changes in TSP this year that the L funds, they introduced a bunch of new ones. It used to be there was only an L every 10 years. Now there's an L for every 5 years. But if you look at the farthest out for our young listeners today, the L 2055, 2060, and 2065 are all almost identical in their allocation. 99% stocks, 1% bonds. This is according to the best research on retirement that I was alluding to earlier today. The number one determinant of what in return you're going to get from a portfolio is how much you put in stocks. Not which stocks you put into, but how much of your portfolio you put into stocks. All right? Then once we get to the L 2045 and ongoing, those funds automatically adjust to a little bit more conservative each year. One of the features of the TSP that people might be interested to know is that they are more conservative than most target date funds out there. If you look like under the hood at a Vanguard target date fund, most companies do these now, right? T. Rowe Price has theirs, USAA has theirs. If you lift up and look under the hood at a target date 2025 fund. For most places, it would be around 50% stock, 60% stock. For an L, it's going to be 50 to 40. And then really, once you get to an L income, it's going to be less than 30% stock. And that can be okay. We just need to know that. We need to be mindful of it. And we need to make our projections on what returns are going to be accordingly. Some people are going to decide when they lift that hood and look under there, wow, that's a little bit more conservative than I was thinking. I think I might like to design it myself. That's okay. You can build a stock allocation yourself in TSP quite easily. There's only two things you need to know. Two places you need to make the change. Most people are making the change just on the contribution allocation for future. You need to know that's not going to change the majority of your investments in TSP. That's only going to change the drip into the bucket. The place to make the majority of your changes to that bucket of water that you've already saved up for retirement is in the interfund transfer screen of TSP.gov. You go in there, you make an allocation change, and that is going to allocate all the money you've already got allocated in TSP.
So in other words, it's I like your methodology, the drip. That's the new money going in, but it's going into a pool.
That's right.
Your pool. And we're going to move some of the water out of the deep end into another end. Right.
That's exactly it. So we want to just shift what we've got in that overall allocation. That's actually the more important one, right? If you've been with the federal government 30 years, there's a lot of money sitting in that pool. We want to change the allocation there. Now, what am I shooting toward? I will say that the best research on retirement, this comes from a paper written over 25 years ago in the Journal of Financial Planning on what is an acceptable withdrawal rate for a portfolio. The number that was arrived at was 4%. Now, 4% was how much I could take sustainably from a portfolio over a 30-year time horizon and not run out of money in any historical scenarios back to 1926. So 1926 to 1955, 1927 to 1956, that rolling time frame all the way forward. If somebody had kept their portfolio invested throughout and started withdrawing 4% in year one, and just took it up by inflation from there, they would have been fine. So 4% is a big number. That the later research has evolved to say, well, if we get a little bit more into, see that was just C fund and F basically, right? A 50% stock US large cap, that's the C fund. 50% short-term bonds, that's pretty similar to the F fund. If you do 50-50 in those and leave it in place for 30 years, the best research says 4%. Now we start mixing in some S, because that's smaller companies, there's a little bit more risk there, a little more return. Start mixing in the I, that's international companies. Now we get a little bit of volatility dampening because US stocks and international stocks move in different timeframes. We mix that in, maybe we can get to 4.5 or 5. But I want people to keep in mind is their number, 4% is what I can take. So now you can start to see where if somebody has already saved a lot of money and they've got to age 60, and they come to me and say, what do I need to have the investments allocated in? Well, if you're planning on working 5 more years, maybe we only need to have 30% stock risk in here if you've oversaved. But let's say that you haven't quite saved enough. Maybe we need to have a higher stock allocation as we're getting toward retirement because we need the portfolio to do more. What I don't want people to think is that there's some magic investment allocation out there that is going to get them a ton of extra return. When we're talking about extra return, I'm talking about 0.5 to 1% per year extra return, which can make a difference over the long term, but it's not going to be the driver. The biggest driver was how much you saved, right?
All right. Brag a little bit. A client comes in and mentally, I think we all say this, whatever profession we're in, and we say this needs some fixing. So brag about your toughest challenge and what it took to get that people out of the spending line or those folks out of spending the money or incurring debt to buy the bigger house or the car and stuff like that. How did that work?
Well, I'd love to say that I win every time, right? I've just been able to make sure that everyone who comes across my desk, they've come out and they can do it all. The fact of the matter is, I even as a financial advisor who has long-term relationships with clients, we're meeting together for, you know, a couple, three times a year, most situations, more often when they've got transitions coming. But most of the work is happening outside of my office. So if it's success, it's because they did the work, right? I may have given some suggestions. If it's not successful, oftentimes it's just because it's too much to change. So I will give an example that I really appreciate from a few years ago. She was not a federal client, but we sat down together, and she was in her early 60s and felt like there was just no way that she was ever going to be able to retire. And the reason she felt that way was because she felt like the rule of thumb said that a mortgage needs to be paid off in order to be able to retire. If you don't have your mortgage paid off, you can't retire, which, by the way, is just not, it's a flawed rule of thumb. What we did when we sat down with together was we looked at, all right, how many more years do you feel like you could be able to work? And it was about five, you know, and she could probably work about five. Well, we looked at the mortgage. Now, there's so many reasons why somebody ends up with a mortgage in retirement. They've had a health issue over their working years. They lost their job for a period of years. In her case, it was because of divorce that had happened about 15 years earlier. And there was just, it was not realistic. So what we did was, with great low interest rates, we redesigned a mortgage for the long term, right? And it was a 30-year mortgage. And there's a lot of research on why that's okay. It's going to go beyond today's program. I can come back and talk about that another time. But the bottom line was to get the monthly spend as low as possible and to maximize what was going into retirement accounts. And 5 years later, she retired a year ago, and we actually just met a little while ago, and she went back to work part-time because she felt good enough about it. And so the things are just getting rosier and rosier. But the important point is this: people can feel like there's no way, I can't do this. You can, all right? There are ways to design this so that it works. And the important thing can be getting a new set of eyes to look at it in a different way than maybe you are looking at it. But what they're not going to do is they're not going to give you some magic investment that's going to earn you 20% per year. It's going to happen in the trenches, looking at what income is going to be coming to you, what spending do you have, and how can we tweak that spending?
Wow. All right, we're sitting today. Times have been good. Market's been really great for a while. I'm not a doomsdayer, but you know, everything can't always go up in that proper degreed angle. So when either that slows down or maybe there's a hiccup, speak to what you would say to a client that says, "Well, I just don't feel good about being where I am." What do you do with them? Say, okay, maybe we take less dollars going into the stock fund and put it over, maybe not into the G, but how do you deal with that so that they understand they have to do something, but they don't like it?
Yeah, this is a great place to kind of pull it all together on time horizons, right? Is that I'm still going to, even in that situation, I'm going to be anchored to looking at when they need the money. That is the number one determinant, right? So if they need the money in 10 years from now, that is the dollar value of the portfolio that's going to matter. Everything that happens between now and then is noise. And sometimes people will tell me, well, markets seem to be kind of highly valued right now. Should I really put my stock portfolio like that? The example I'll give comes from the late 1990s. And some people who listeners of this program might remember when Alan Greenspan was the chair of the Federal Reserve, and he used a phrase in testimony to the Fed to the Congress that talked about irrational exuberance. He said that markets were approaching irrational exuberance, right? Which the phrase kind of caught in the social memory. And people thought of it as, oh, irrational exuberance. Maybe that means markets are too hot, right? Maybe we should sell. Well, we remember that as being said in the late 90s, and people think it was said in like 99, right before the collapse. Alan Greenspan made that testimony to Congress in late 1996. And the interesting thing is, if you took a look, if somebody acted on Alan Greenspan's statement of irrational exuberance, said, oof, I need to pull out of this market and I'll reinvest later. And they had reinvested at they pulled the cash, went to cash, and they put it all back in at the market bottom in October of 2002, which was when the bottom ultimately happened. They still would have had less in their portfolios than someone who looked at what Alan Greenspan said, Yeah, but I don't need the money for 15 years. So what markets do over the next 6 months is pretty much irrelevant. I'm just going to stay anchored to my long term. If they had done that, the markets ended up climbing enough from 1996 to 2000, all along the way, people saying it's too high, it's too high. And then when they ultimately dropped, and they did drop huge, that person who had gone to cash in 1996 and went and timed it perfectly, which who does that, right? Who can time it perfectly when the market bottoms? They're going to put it in when it feels more comfortable. But even if they'd hit that perfectly, they still would have ended up with less than someone who had just been slow and steady all the way, building a long-term allocation saying, what is happening? The headlines of the day don't matter. When I need the money at retirement matters.
That's interesting. And I suppose there are other time periods earlier than that, but we have a reference that maybe not everybody remembers Alan Greenspan, but probably more going to remember than what the person was 20 years earlier than that.
Yeah, I think what's important here is that could have been the high. Right? It could have been the high and markets could have dropped from there. But when you need the money 20 years from now, it's less relevant. What is much more relevant and probably good for our listeners who are approaching retirement right now to be mindful of is the best times to trim stock allocation are when markets are at highs. And so if people have reached their retirement goals and they know that, hey, this is pretty much what I need, now's a very appropriate time to consider dialing back.
Joel,
they're dialing back
Joel,
to their time horizon.
Joel, Andrew says you have less than a minute to give the folks what they need. So final comments, please.
Yeah, I hopefully that people understood from today that goal planning is critical. Understanding how many years it is until you need the money matters. And that you're going to have a meaningful stock allocation for most people throughout retirement. But we do want to dial it back at market highs, not at market lows.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Professor. And for the folks listening, tell your friends about it. I'll tell the folks that aren't listening they should. Thank you very much. Happy Financial Literacy Month.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.